Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, financial statement analysis. This is the second of the two lectures on financial statements, and I will be showing you how to get to financial statements, which is useful for you for subjects other than just this, and how you manipulate, how you get them downloaded as Excel sheets and all of that, so that it's for at least a number of you, you'll have projects in other classes where you'll have to look at companies, and knowing how to get their financial statements is something that can help you if you are writing doing a project or a term paper that involves analyzing a company's financial stability or something of that nature. And it's a fairly compact lecture. Unfortunately, one of the things that I will do whether I want to or not is bring up taxes and how they impact on the corporation. I'm not going to give you something that allows you to become a tax accountant, but there are a few rules that are worth having a look at in this. But before we do that, a look at the numbers as we always do. And if we look at, A look at the numbers, sorry about that, had it muted, gets us into the mode of thinking about financial statements, because remember, some of these numbers actually come off those financial statements, but most of it is not accounting numbers that I'm going to show you later. These are market numbers, the actual ebb and flow of buys and sells and all that. And if we look on the other side of the world, the yen has had a couple of days, the Tokyo exchange has been having a few sour days. Now, just as a background, it wasn't that many months ago that there was talk of Japan slipping into a mild recession. And I haven't heard a lot about that recently, but the performance of their exchange, the stocks on their exchange, seems to indicate that there is a good degree of bearish sentiment right now over there. And as you can see, the Nikkei 225 was barely up. It had spent the whole day as negative. And then, as you can see in the spark charts, there right in the last hour, even less than an hour, it began to rally. And I saw that late last night, that suddenly there was just this buying, and it kind of came out of this negative where it had been for a few days and got into the positive territory. It wasn't anything at all spectacular, but at least it was up for the trading day over there at 0.05 on the green side. And the Hang Seng was just up spectacularly. Anything you see above maybe 1.5%, something like that, that's a really strong bear, a bull day. And here we have definitely a bull day more than 2.5% up. And of course, that's the consequences of the world shifting in ways that we haven't seen in decades, three quarters of a century or more than that. You are actually living through a very dynamic time in economic and financial history of the world, as trading alliances move rapidly away from the United States and toward just simply interlocking the rest of the world without us in it. And that will continue over the time to come. And a little later in the course, I will be showing you how to read currency exchange rates. And I just did that. I was even taken a little aback because I went across a bunch of currencies, what their exchange rates are to the dollar. And it was just across the board. The dollar is just depreciating rapidly across multiple currencies, the euro, the yen, and all of these other currencies, even the peso, for heaven's sakes. The dollar is just simply being set aside. So I'll show you how to read those numbers. And remember, these are not some biased numbers. There's no secret deep state conspiring to do this. This is just the markets of the world, millions of traders doing their thing and moving. Everyone seems to be moving in the same direction. Now, over on our side of the Atlantic, let me make a point here. The Paris Exchange was down. Negative 1% is a good drop. And so we have the CAC 40 on the Paris Exchange slipping noticeably today. And up here. Now, I do want to point out, in full disclosure, I am not too familiar with what is in the Euronext. It is a broad-based index, but I don't know exactly what is in it. Are these the exchanges themselves, or are the stocks on the different exchanges in the European network? I'm not sure, and I don't want to talk too much about it until I am more familiar and comfortable with it. But it is clearly, it was down today. There was a bearish sentiment in Europe. And of course, that spilled over into London with the FTSE 100, which suffered a down day. It wasn't horribly down, just 0.5%, but still, you could see that there was definitely a broad bearish sentiment over on the other side of the Atlantic. So we can keep that in mind. Now, if we look over here, the Dow was up just a measly, almost meaningless 0.02% so far today. We're still not done with trading for the day, but it is definitely on the skids here. And then the S&P 500, it's down just a tiny bit. Basically, this is just flat. Those kinds of tiny percentages up or down, that's just saying that the market isn't going anywhere. It's just wandering aimlessly. Now, the NASDAQ should have been up a little bit, but even that one, the NASDAQ up 0.15% is not anything interesting at all. So essentially right now, the markets here in the United States are in a holding period, sort of a wait and see kind of place. And we just have to say, okay, what's next? And that's what the basically a few traders that I talk to say, we're just waiting for the next big event to give us some information to move the market up or down, but we don't have any right now. Coming over here, just for a little bit of excitement, gold is roaring upward, $5,355.50 it is now. I would suspect that at this pace, by just after the spring break, we may see an insane $6,000 an ounce on gold. And it just keeps going up. The gold investors are saying the end is near. Some kind of an apocalyptic movement of the markets is about to occur. And they are so convinced, they're just throwing all of their investable money into gold right now. And so are they right? Well, I don't know whether they're right or wrong, but they sure are convinced that something's happening. These prices are just not even heard of. And so is gold a good investment? It's awfully risky. It's just really risky stuff. And only the most devoted investors, the devoted ultra bears, are going to be getting into that. Now crude seems to be kind of having a movement upward. From what I hear, there's a little more concern right now about a war in the Middle East. There were some pretty harsh words exchanged between Iran and the United States over the past 24 hours, and that's given the gold traders, or rather the oil traders, reason to be a little more jittery, so that risk is translating into a higher price, but at a low probability, they're not going to go crazy driving the price of crude oil up. And of course, Brent crude kind of follows the same path as crude, the overall crude. And there's just a little more concern right now on what's going on around in the Middle East. But a few other ones that are kind of worth keeping an eye on, of course, silver. There are some investors. Look at what silver did since yesterday. It's up 6%. What I've heard is that there are some investors, they say, don't bother gold. Gold is just too, there are too many crazies in that market. It's just too unpredictable. And there are some investors who are interested in getting a little bit of safe harbor in hard metals, who are starting to pay attention, more attention to silver. Silver used to not have a lot of influence from speculators. But as you see there, up 6% in one day, that means that there is an awful lot of buying that isn't just for industrial or cosmetic purposes. That would tell me that, yeah, there are some speculators beginning to, yeah, gold is just ridiculous and it's too expensive, but silver is still on the table because if there is a bad economic time, silver is a pretty good safe harbor. It's a hard metal. It has value that is above its intrinsic value because it is pretty and it's great for a lot of things. So we might see that one going up a little more. Now, oh, here's an interesting thing. The markets are pretty much flat today. So you've got about as many reds as greens on the sector map. Obviously, technology stocks are just going to keep going up come hell or high water. But you see more reds on other ones that usually don't show red. Financial services, and of course, consumer cyclicals and consumer defensive. Consumer defensives oftentimes are red, even when the rest of the market is green. So that doesn't mean a whole lot. But you've got the industrials, which are a little bit, that's a little bit troubling here, the industrials. So that one, there is, we can't rely on the numbers out of the government. However, there are private services that put their pulse on manufacturing. And their numbers are showing all kinds of red flags about weakening of the industrial sector. It's not as major as it used to be in the United States. However, it is still a big thing. And the concern is that as the industrial sector begins to weaken, that is a lot of jobs that could end up being people being laid off. So we have to be a little careful about keeping an eye on that. And like I said, we can't believe what the government is publishing right now, but these private services, they don't have some political agenda. They're just reporting what they've gotten from all the manufacturers and all the retailers and all of the companies. They just get it out to us without worrying about whether it makes the government look good or bad. Let me take you over to a couple of companies here. And one that I'm going to use for, I had to think about financial statements come in all kinds of flavors in terms of how easy they are to read. I mean, one of the things that used to be in play is that financial statements from one company to another looked so much the same. The same names for each row, and they had the same rows and all of that. Somehow over the last probably, I don't know, maybe about 5 years ago, I started noticing it really strongly. They started using different names for the same things. One statement would say operating income. Another would say earnings before interest and taxes. One financial statement would have depreciation expense listed in the income statement. There are others that don't put it in there. Companies used to all put in gross income. Not all of the companies, you put that line in there anymore. And it's just like, even the names of the financial statements aren't always the same. Instead of income statement, now you'll have consolidated statement of operations, and all of this kind of stuff. So even the names of the financial statements vary from one company to another. And that's a big problem. And I was trying to find a couple of companies that would have financial statements that were pretty obvious, pretty easy to read. And one of those that I worked came out with is a highly, highly controversial company. However, it is an interesting company to look at from a financial statements point of view, because it was losing money until just a couple of years ago. And it's Palantir. Now, if you don't know what Palantir is, let me tell you. It is a data collection enterprise. It is finding out everything it possibly can about everyone. It is the place where you can get all manner of data on at a granular level and at an aggregate level. They do things like, for example, for more than a few years, they were putting up little fun quizzes on Facebook. And people would say, oh, this is cool. I'll find out what my spirit animal is or what my ancestry is. And you take this quiz and they tell you some nonsense that was not true. But what they were doing was profiling you. They were building an index of people. And the data points that defined one person from another, one group of people from another group of people. And then at this point, they have now joined forces in the last couple of years with the government, U.S. government. And it's, I don't like to use this term, and I apologize for this, but essentially that data is being weaponized against all of us. And it's run by an ultra billionaire who has a very checkered past that is being revealed now, but that's irrelevant to us. But the question is, Palantir, let's look at its financials. It is, we can see, okay, this is interesting. Do you see that bid-ask spread? We'll start with that. The bid-ask spread, that's actually pretty wide. The bid, in other words, you could sell a share of Palantir at $157.51. You could buy a share of Palantir at $163.61. So in other words, the bid-ask spread there is $6.10. That is a hell of a bid-ask spread. I mean, usually we talk about the spreads a couple of pennies or maybe 20 cents or 50 cents maybe. That's a huge bid-ask spread on this stock right now. The question is, well, what's going on here? Well, we're not going to get much help. We're not going to get much help from the volume. Now, we are only about halfway through, maybe a little more than halfway through the day. And the volume is 26 million. On an average entire day over the last 52 weeks, the average volume has been about 45 million shares. So it's not like the volume is super weak. Oftentimes, if the volume is weak on a given day, there's not a lot of buy and selling. You'll see the bid and the ask begin to spread apart on each other. But here, this looks like it's going to be a pretty normal day as far as volume goes. So that one is off the table as an explanation for that bid-ask spread of $6.10. But anyway, we can see that over the past year, 52 weeks, the stock has gone from 66.12 to 207.52. I mean, it's kind of hard to tell. That's about in the middle, where we are now at 159.63. That's about in the middle. Now, let me look at the one-year chart here, and we'll just see what that says. Come on, one year. So that bid-ask spread, the 66.12 looks like it was right there over the past year. That was the low for the year. Now, the high for the year was $207. That would be that peak right there. So right now, it looks visually to me like we're closer to the top than we are to the bottom. See how the market price right now, 159, that is closer to the high over the last year than it is to the low over the last year. It's just something to think about. Just put that in. There's no single number that tells you is this a good investment. It's sort of like just looking at all the numbers and creating a composite understanding of this company, not from one number, but from a cluster of numbers. Now, very quickly here, the beta is very high. This is a high-risk company. In a very important way, Palantir is a high-technology company. It's using very powerful computers, a lot of artificial intelligence involved in it, to create an understanding of what people are and what they buy. What are their hot buttons? What are their disinterests? And so in a very real sense, Palantir is a high-tech company. And as such, you should expect the beta to be kind of high. This is quite high. It's not as bad as a Tesla or an Nvidia, but it's still up there high enough that it's probably a stock that you would not want to invest in unless you're an institutional investor with a real taste for risk. It's just too volatile to rely on as something that you want to put into a normal investor's portfolio. Now, look at the PE ratio on it. Can you tell me? Remember, the PE ratio tells undervalued or overvalued. What say you? Is this undervalued or overvalued? Look at the PE at 371. Any thought? Yes, it is insanely overvalued. You remember the number I said, kind of like where it's right at about intrinsic value? Yeah, it's okay, it's 30. About, and that depends really on the industry. You have to look at the industry PE ratio average to be really, to do this right, but in general, anything above 30 would be overvalued. Anything below 30 would be undervalued. Now, you'll have other analysts who will say, no, 25. Others would say, no, 40. So this is just sort of an individual professional's sentiment on this. But when you get to a price-earnings ratio of 371, there is no question that this is an overvalued stock. It is ridiculously overvalued. That is what we're seeing across the technology, high technology industry, is these incredibly overvalued stocks. Nvidia, Palantir, Tesla, all of them and others in this world of high technology, they are all just amazingly overvalued. Now, does that mean they're all going to collapse in price tomorrow? Absolutely not. Overvaluation can last months and even in some cases years. So it's not enough to say, well, Palantir is overvalued, let's go short Palantir, let's sell our Palantir. That's not necessarily a good idea. Just don't know that if you're buying this stock right now, you're buying something that is extremely overpriced. If you like to buy overpriced securities, that's a personal preference. Some investors actually do, because they believe that if it's overpriced, then that the investors buying it and driving up its price aren't going to let go. They're just going to keep driving its price higher and higher and higher. Even if though it's overvalued, they'll just keep buying more of it. And there are actually some good reasons why some of them can. You've got a lot of the Wall Street firms, they've put so much money into these companies that if the price collapsed, they could end up actually being instantly insolvent. And so they have an incentive to keep buying the stock, to keep propping the price up. They will pour in millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars if the stock price starts to slide too much, because they've got to keep reinforcing it to keep it from dropping, because if it drops, then their balance sheet, mark to market, would essentially go into negative territory in some cases. So just because it's overvalued doesn't mean it's going to drop in price, especially if there is incentive among the very powerful firms on Wall Street to keep it overvalued for their own sake. Keep that in mind. Now, you notice something important here. First of all, Palantir is actually profitable. It's got a positive price to earnings. So that means earnings has to be positive. Profit has to be positive. It's not spectacularly positive, but it is positive. And you'll see this when I open up Palantir's financial statements. Palantir only in the past couple of years has been profitable. It was losing money hand over fist for a long time. But then as it began to get into a closer and closer relationship with our government and all of the money that our government will pay for all of these details about every citizen, then it started becoming profitable. And it will probably stay profitable from here on out, because once the government gets a taste for data about people, it will never get over that addiction. And so Palantir does have a positive future, despite the fact that it does something that is really, really annoying, and despite the fact that the owner, the high chief dog of it, is a very controversial figure, as will be revealed. We already know, for one thing, that the Peter Thiel is in the Epstein files. We've seen his name there quite a number of times. So we do know that the CEO is a highly controversial figure, but things like that don't matter at all to us in finance. As morally wrong or whatever you want to call it, is the company going to make a lot of money for its owners? And the answer is probably so. Is the stock price going to keep going up even though it's overvalued? Probably so. And so this is that caution that we always have to think of in the background of our investments. Keeping our opinions out of it and just using hard thinking, numbers and critical thinking and rational thought. Yeah, this could be a good investment, even if it's a strongly risky stock at 1.51 beta. Let me take you over here now. I was going to look at one other thing, but maybe I'll just lay off that for the day here. I want to take you to a website. Now, I would encourage you, some of you already know about this. It was supposed to have been shown to you in Business 100, although I don't know that there's a lot of emphasis on this one, except in your Milner Library Research Project. But we have access to a number of extremely expensive databases that out there in the normal world would cost a fortune in subscription fees. And I'm going to show you one here, but we have a number. We have ones like ProQuest. We have Business Source Complete. They have just vast oceans of sound data. These are what professionals use. They don't ever go to sites like Wikipedia or Investopedia for information. We go to the sites that are behind paywalls. That's a problem with artificial intelligence. Asking it to find numbers for you, to do statistical analysis, they can't get behind the paywalls. So all they can do is go to these sites that are free, that have biased data, false data, and when they can't find data, artificial intelligence just makes it up. It just invents data. We all know it. We call it hallucinations in AI. They just make up data. The what I'm showing you here is reliable, as it's as reliable as we can get. And we have subscriptions to a number of databases, and they are available to you as students. As long as you're a student or a faculty member here at ISU, you have access to these databases that would otherwise cost a freaking fortune. Now, one of them, the one I'm going to focus on here, by the way, let me make a side point here. The best database to get financial statements used to be the Security and Exchange Commission's EDGAR filing system. A long, long time ago, when I was a consultant, one of the ways I made money was by doing regular reports that are required by the SEC of public companies. You had to make them on paper in triplicate every quarter, every year. And some were more were on a kind of a random basis. But this EDGAR system, 2 years ago, I could click on that button and I could get my financial statements reported to the United States government in the new electronic EDGAR system. I could download them. Any public company, I could do that to. Mysteriously, I did not know what happened. In a class like this one, I think it was just a year ago now, I pulled up EDGAR to get some financial statements. You can't get them now. It's public information, but the SEC no longer lets you find them. There are ways that you can write scripts to get around the wall, but it's really not worth it. The go-to, and this is the go-to for any professional in finance or in other subjects as well, it's called S&P Global Net Advantage. Now, I'm going to read out for the podcast the URL of this site. It's GUIDES.library, LIBRARY, I'm sorry, .IllinoisState, all one word, .edu/ BUS100 / SPGLOBAL GUIDES.LIBRARY.ILLINOISSTATE.EDU/BUS100/SPGLOBAL. And again, I'm doing this for the podcast for you. I've also got a file in your files folder in Canvas. Just go Canvas Files, and you'll see a little Word document, and that has this link in it. Okay, now, this is the site that is professionals. Sometimes it takes a while to actually get through the portal because it is being used all the time by hundreds of thousands of subscribers to the Global Net Advantage. But down here you'll see accessing S&P Global Net Advantage, and you'll see a link, S&P Global Net Advantage. Click on this link. Now, what's going to happen when you click on that link? You will be taken through a portal. You choose Milner Library at Illinois State University. There are a couple of different options for how to go through the portal, but this is the one you'll use, Milner Library at Illinois State University. Now it's going to walk into the portal. Hey, it's pretty fast today. Sometimes it just grinds. Don't despair. If it just hangs there, that means it's just being the servers are just loaded. Now, when you look at it on the front, it doesn't look very interesting. But let's type in the trading symbol of Palantir. You can do that. Best to use the trading symbol, because if you type in the name of a company, there might be more than one company with almost the same name. But if I type in the trading symbol, PLTR, it'll show the first selection will be Palantir Technologies. Click on it. And what happens is an ocean of possible sources of data on the left sidebar. You can get, I'm going to do ratios with you in class in just a week or so. It gives you all the ratios. We don't even have to calculate ratios anymore. It gives you all the ratios, financial ratios. You can pull out key industry statistics, key statistics, the cash flow, everything that you could possibly want, including the financial statements, which are downloadable as Excel files. For other kinds of research, you will be able to go down here and find out the names of all the officers and directors. You'll find out the board members, who they are, what their resumes are, anything. Analyses by the best experts in the world of the company and its management. All of that is available to you here in this. So that's where we would begin to do research, is if we're doing it at the college level, at the professional level, we go here. Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage has everything that we need. Now, the first thing that I would want to do here, just to get down to the business here, I'm going to run here into where the heck, oh, there we go. The income statement, balance sheet, and statement of cash flows. Those are the ones that we use the most. Those are our go-tos for financial analysis. So the first one I'll pull up is the income statement. And there it is. A couple of pieces of advice. One thing is that I click on more options so I can see everything. Decimals, it likes one decimal. A lot of times, most professionals prefer two or four. So I'll change that to a two. Give me two decimal places of accuracy on these. And another thing that is a lot of presentations, well, it's kind of divided. Do you report from the from the left to the right, or oldest to newest, or from the left to the right, newest to oldest? There's been a trend that S&P Global hasn't picked up yet of reporting the latest on the left. So I'm going to choose latest on the left. And then I'm going to click go. Just like in any job you'll ever do, you will arrange your working platform to fit you. You'll move things around. That's normal in everything from the office to the factory floor. And you can customize these as you want. So I will download the financials as a page, as an Excel file. Now, it might take it a while. Completed. Palantir. And we'll open it up. I'll bring it over here for you to see. Let's try that again. Open it. Now, as you can see, you've got your income statement, balance sheet, statement of cash flows, even the stupid ratios that I'm going to teach you how to do, you've got them right here, all of them. This is kind of annoying anymore, but you know, here we are. But here's all the information right here in front of you, here for you to use as you wish. And this is gold, because once you have the data into Excel, you can do all kinds of charts and things like that. As a matter of fact, even Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage has a lot of charts you can customize and then copy them and paste them into a term paper. So there's a lot of use for this, even when you're just doing college work. This is for you as well as for industry professionals. Now, as you can see here, we can flow down through, and you've got the latest. Now, a little caution here. Most companies, a lot of companies, are their fiscal year is their calendar year. However, most companies don't have to report their latest year's results until March. So until March, we kind of have to estimate what, like in this case, fiscal 2025 was. We don't know it yet because the company hasn't reported it yet. They have 90 days to get it done. I think it's 90 days now. So do keep that in mind a little bit, that those numbers at the far left are not authoritative. However, we can look at it as it is. Now, we look at Palantir, and we're going to do a lot of manipulating of these kinds of numbers. It's not hard to do, find out percentage changes and all of that. But in this operation right here, before you go any further in financial analysis, put down your calculator, put down your put down your pen and pencil, and just look at the numbers. This is the same thing that I was taught many, many years ago in the service. You don't go into a battle not knowing the layout. You do a recon. You get a sense of the layout of the land. And in this case, it's just kind of like a little bit of common sense. Ma'am, is Palantir a company that is growing? Look at the revenue. Yes. Is it just a little bit of growth, or is it a lot of growth? Now, this one's a little harder. It's a lot. It's insane how fast this company is growing. It is just skyrocketing in its growth. And there's no stopping. It looks like there's no stopping. It's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger as its databases get more and more complete and it gets more buyers for the data that it has on everyone. Yeah, this is a company. It's got the most important product of the 21st century. It's got information, and that is gold. So yeah, this. See how the revenue is just climbing over the past 5 years? I can't see this very well, but it has more than doubled, well more than doubled over the past 5 years. You see that? Going from 1.5 billion up to 3.8 billion in just 5 years. That is growth, that's cancerous growth. And if you look at it, thank you, the cost of goods sold. Notice how the cost of goods sold is actually a very small component of this company's cost. That heavy duty operating cost is relatively small. And it's not, the cost of the goods sold is more than doubling too. So they are tracking each other. That cost of goods sold is tracking the revenue upward. In other words, it's not overrunning the revenue, which is a big problem these days, and it's not tailing downward. It's just keeping good track. Now, this is a line that is very important, gross profit. Like I said, financial statements these days, some companies don't report their gross profit. It's really important for us. Think of gross profit as what's left after you've paid your wholesale price. That's what it is. It's what's left after you pay your wholesale price. I mean, I have a cost of goods sold, and I look at, okay, I can sell a typical artwork that runs at about $800, has a cost of goods sold of about $275. So the difference between those is how much I am keeping over wholesale at my from my retail sales. So the gross income has meaning to us. It's an operating, it's a strong operating expense. So it matters to cash flow. So we care about that. Now, SG&A, you'll hear me call it SG&A, selling, general, and administrative expenses. That's your wages and salaries, that's your light bills, that's your advertising, that's all of those, meals and entertainment, whatever you, those are operating expenses. So they matter to us because they are an actual drain on cash flow. We write checks for SG&A. So it too is a pull down. Now we go on here and we look at R&D expense. That one is difficult to call. Is it an operating expense or is it something not like an operating expense? There's a debate about that among professionals, but we can see that it's that constitutes a pretty big part of Palantir's costs. It's just the R&D they're doing with the artificial intelligence engines, sorting through the data, creating the profiles, discovering how we make people, can get people to do what we want them to do. That's huge stuff. And they do it, and it is a cost. See how big that cost is? It's noticeable. That thing is bigger than, what is that? That thing is actually bigger than your SG&A. It's almost double. R&D expense is a heavy, heavy expense. That constitutes almost half of the, as much as your selling, general, and administrative expenses. But going down here, now they are reporting that they have no depreciation or amortization expense, which is a little bit weird because most companies do. But one way or the other, depreciation expense isn't an operating expense. However, if you have it, it kind of protects some of your revenue from taxation. So we kind of have a mixed view of it. We keep it in there for a while until we see how much it's saved us on taxes. But then at the end of the day, before we calculate free cash flow, we have to kick it back out. And then we drive ourselves down and we get to operating income. That is from operations. How much did we make from operations? Taking out operating expenses from your revenue, what was left of the company's expenses? Now, if we can come down here, we'll have a couple more lines that we have to just kind of take notice of. If I come down here, interest, okay, yeah, that's. Yeah. Now, the next one is not an operating expense, and it has two faces to it, interest expense. There's the interest expense that the company pays on the money it has borrowed, the capital that it has borrowed. But then it gets interest from investments it's made lending to other companies. So in other words, I owe you $500,000 in interest for the current year. However, you owe me, I lent you money and you owe me $100,000. So the net of those is negative $400,000. $500,000 out, $100,000 in. So we have to include both of those for companies. And it's kind of weird. You've got companies that borrow money, but they also lend money. So in other words, they're both surplus and deficit economic units at the same time. Sounds weird, but it's done all the time. Especially if I want to attach myself to you. You're a company that needs money, and I kind of need you to be on my team. I might be the one who lends you money. Even though I borrow money, I have an interest in making you my kind of like my dependent for a while. So that's what's happening here. Coming down here, drilling it in, you've got these other things, non-operating income, and impairment of goodwill, gains and losses. Those are non-operating expense, non-operating, but let me get down here to your taxes. Income taxes. I'm going to avoid talking as much as possible, talking about taxes, but there are a couple of things that I would be remiss if I did not do in this regard. Okay, just put these in your notes and just kind of keep them in the back of your mind. I will not hit you hard on taxes at all. Truth be told, this time of year, I am preparing my own company's business taxes. So taxes, kind of every time I say the word, I feel a little bit of a growl in the pit of my stomach. But anyway, here's the thing. Okay. Since the time taxes first happened in the early part of the 20th century, the corporate and rich people's top tax bracket was around 90%. In other words, if companies made a huge amount of money, then the last dollar or a person or a family made a huge amount of money, then the last dollar of that would be taxed at the rate of 90 cents. We had a progressive tax system. Each layer of money got taxed at a higher and higher rate. And even into the 1950s, when the economy was growing at just an awesome rate, the corporate tax rate was about 90%, 90, 91%. It was, by the standards of what they scream about today, it was it's horrible. Interestingly, even in that time, corporations screamed bloody murder about how high the tax rate was. However, they didn't move very hard to buy politicians to cut their tax rates. The reason was this: a huge amount of money the government was bringing in was being brought in to build the country's infrastructure. Everything from roads to telephone lines to what have you. It was all being used to the benefit, not just of the citizens, but of the companies and the corporations that were in the United States. So even though corporations bitched about the high tax rates, they really did get it that, okay, this has a purpose. Now, that tax rate went down to 70% because of all the grousing, but it stayed there for a long, long time until we got to an era when there was a much more, comprehensive push to bring down the top tax bracket. And ultimately, for corporations, it went down to 39%. And I believe that was the Tax Act of 1981. We were in a serious recession, and the president, Ronald Reagan, he convinced everyone that the way of the future was lower taxes for corporations. And that's where it stayed for a very long time, until the Tax Act of 2017, and the president was Donald Trump, his first administration. And it was brought down. It was no longer a progressive tax system where each higher dollar was taxed at a higher rate. It went to a flat 21%, where it is now. The tax on corporations is now only 21%. There was a push during this newest Trump administration that they wanted to bring it down to 15%. Now, the consequence of this is, of course, that the government does not take in nearly as much money. And so our budget deficits and therefore our national debt have skyrocketed. That's just the thing. Bring it down to 15% would accelerate that catastrophic trend, but it's probably not going to happen now because of the political weakness that is beginning to show up in the White House. They can't get, they probably won't get the Congress to lower it any further. However, okay, so 21% is the statutory. Now there's all kinds of ifs, ands, ors, and buts about that. First of all, 21% on the corporate tax side. Let me think how I want to, okay. First of all, interest, see that interest expense line up there? The company, for calculating its taxes, it can subtract that interest expense only to the extent that it is no more than 30% of their revenues. So, or operating income, I should say, I think it is. In other words, they can't just subtract all of their interest expense. If that interest expense is too much, they are limited to subtracting only the interest from before they calculate taxes, only to the extent that the interest is less than or equal to 30% of operating income. I think it's operating income. Might want to check that. Okay, that's the first thing. Now, a couple of other things about the taxes too. Tax, if a company is losing money, then it has negative taxes. What it can do is carry those losses forward into the future. It lost a bunch of money, so it had negative taxes. So what it can do is, it's if the company starts making money, it can use those tax losses against future positive income. Now, it can also do a little bit of tax loss carry back as well. One of the reasons that a company will buy a bankrupt company is so that it can use that dead company's tax losses to get back some of the money that it has already paid in taxes in previous years. So that's a tax loss carryback. You can't do it for a long period of time, but you can carry back and say, hey, we overpaid taxes because now we have this company that we got a tax loss that we can carry back on it. So that's another thing that is part of this morass, this mess. Now, another thing is that when a company owns other companies, and I talked about this on Monday, it doesn't have to include all of its dividends that it earns from the other company as income to the parent company. So in other words, if I bought stock in your company, sir, and you paid me a dividend, I'm a corporation, I buy stock in your corporation pays a dividend, I get a dividend check in my corporation. Now, normally that would just be ordinary income. To an individual, to a household, that is. I have to add that to my taxable income. But I don't have to add all of it to my income for taxation if I'm a corporation. Sounds kind of interesting. That is one of the reasons corporations are buying each other. They're buying stock in each other, is because then they pay dividends. And it's essentially, at least part of it, is untaxed money to the dividend recipient companies. Now, this gets deep, and I'm certainly not going to beat the hell out of you on a quiz or an exam with this. This is just lightweight questions about this I would put on. But it does, for the purposes of you being academics and business people, this is part of what you need to know that the average person doesn't know. You don't have to know all the details of it, but it is beneficial to you in your understanding of what's going on in the economy and all that, if you know these kinds of details that are too difficult for the average person to know. Why don't you do your attendance radar right now? I almost forgot about it. Yeah, make sure that you are using an ISU at ISU.edu account in your attendance radar. Otherwise, it won't count. And while you're doing that, I'll just set up a couple of things here. The next on the list is the balance sheet. I'm not going to raise holy hell about this, but the balance sheet, as I told you, is the end result of the other financial statements. It shows a statement of the condition of the company at the end of a fiscal year or another period, like the end of the quarter or whatever. It is a culmination of calculations on scratch sheets, basically. The income statement is a scratch sheet. The statement of cash flows is a scratch sheet. We get the numbers from those and we plug them into the balance sheet. A couple of things to bring up to you here. The first thing is the idea of current assets and current liabilities. These are liquid. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Now, if you go on the internet, Google, Wikipedia, Investopedia, any number of sites will give you an incorrect definition. They will say liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be converted to cash. That's useless to us. Ease is a meaningless word. The word is efficiency. Converted into cash, well, how do you talk about the liquidity of cash if cash is in the definition? Liquidity is ease with which cash can be converted into cash. That means nothing. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Now, I always ask this. I always ask this on a quiz and possibly an exam or two, simply because I will give you the chance to say, use ease and cash, and then I'll know how many people are using definitions from the internet instead of definitions from lectures. But these are the liquid within a year. Liquid assets and liquid assets and current assets and current liabilities are transactional within a year. So on this side, you would, on the current assets, you'd have cash, you'd have accounts receivable, you'd have inventory, you might have prepaid expenses, things that are happening within a year. On the current liabilities side, the big one is accounts payable, wages and salaries payable, and the current portion payable of long-term debt, things that are happening within the year. An important word here is net working capital. Net working capital, NWC. Now there's one that I'll use later, net operating working capital. But net working capital is current assets minus current liabilities. Current assets minus current liabilities. You see, if a current asset goes up, that's actually a drain on cash flow, because I've given you this example already, but if I sell an artwork for $1,200, but $800 of that was on credit, I offer buyer's credit because it increases sales. But the fact of the matter is that it shows up on my accounting income statement as $1,200. You made $1,200. No, I didn't. I actually made only $400. The $800 went into current assets. It increased my accounts receivable. So $800 going up means that I had a drain on cash flow relative to what I said in the income statement. So current assets going up. Is free cash flow going down? But then when the customer pays off that $800, my current asset goes down. But that's money in my account. So that means that when current assets go down, my free cash flow increases. Put this in your notes, just like what I've written it here, because this is, makes it easy for you to answer a question on a test. Well, inventory went up. Well, if inventory goes up, I had to pay for it. That means that that current asset going up caused free cash flow to pull down. Any current asset going up means that I bled cash. And when current assets go down, when I sell that inventory, well, or I get my money from someone who borrowed, who did credit with me, well, that means that I actually achieved something. I got free cash flow. Now, looking on the other side of this is, I'm trying to turn that thing off and it still is barking at me. Current liabilities. You work for me. I pay you well. $50 a week. I know, I'm a giver. $50 a week, okay? So you're expecting me to pay you that $50. And I'm going to say on my income statement, I paid you $50. Okay, I'm going to pay you next week. I'll catch up with you. I didn't pay you. Even though I said on the income statement that I paid you $50, what really happened was all I did was put up my wages payable by $50. That frees up cash for me. We call it spontaneous financing. Thank you for that. You didn't get your $50. So when current liabilities go up, free cash flow goes up. Because I didn't pay a bill that I said I was going to pay. At the same time, though, when I pay you, my accounts payable go down. I finally give you the money. But that means my free cash flow went down too. So when current liabilities go down, free cash flow goes down. Just get these in your notes. And then they're available to you for a quiz. You don't even have to think about the logic of it, although I hope you can see what I'm doing here with this. There are all kinds of other things too here. One thing that I will bring up just as a final note here. Down here, I want you to look at Palantir. I'm going to very quickly show you Palantir's total shareholder equity. Shareholder equity, where is it? Come on. Where is it? There it is. Total common equity. Right now, the accounting is saying that this company's owners have $6.59 billion in equity. Now, let me take this off the screen. Oh, well, let me do this. Real quick, finance.yahoo.com. Markets. And I'll take you over here. And I'm going to show you Palantir, what the market says the company is worth. The market cap of Palantir is $379 billion. You see a little bit of a difference? They're both reporting the same number, except that the one I showed you, that six or whatever it was, that was what the accountants think it is. The one there is what the market thinks it is. Notice the difference. That's all I have for you. I thank you.